Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 81 at the very beginning, which is old single column, page 900. Okay, we have this final paper. In this long series stemming from Adam and Eve's arrival, taking us through all of the Adamite doings and the Adamsonite doings and then the Andite doings and what have you, and all their interactions with the evolutionary peoples and to the east and to the west and everything in between. And so now they want to kind of wrap up the story with this final cherry on the top paper. And I'll say a couple more things about it after we read the first paragraph in the preface. You kind of can tell that there's something afoot, because the title doesn't sound like the Andites doing something or other. It seems to remind you of way back when we were doing the civilization papers. So why don't we just jump in, read that first paragraph, and you'll see that they actually hint at what they're up to.
Paper 81, Development of Modern Civilization. Regardless of the ups and downs of the miscarriage of the plans for world betterment projected in the missions of Calgastia and Adam, the basic organic evolution of the human species continued to carry the races forward in the scale of human progress and racial development. Evolution can be delayed, but it cannot be stopped.
So before I speak to what I was just hinting at, notice that last little sentence. And how, sure enough, that's kind of where we left things at the end of the preceding paper. Remember, we inescapably found ourselves, again, reminding ourselves of that fact that if Revelation drops the ball, eventually evolution picks up the slack. It's inexorable. And so you see, sure enough, they're basically reminding you of that same fact there to start this paper off, that there can be all kinds of ups and downs of various sorts, but there is a smooth, gradual, overarching evolutionary influence coming down from supremacy that won't be jostled about, because there's no finite thing bigger. It can't do anything but stand unmoved, and just inexorably superimpose its purposing upon the finite. And when all is said and done, no matter how much it might seem, like just in that sentence we were talking about, contrasting evolution and revelation, where it might seem that revelation is some sort of a, can't expect evolution to do this, we need to insert ourselves in the game here and tweak things. It's like, it's that, yes, but not in the biggest sense of the picture. Because in the biggest sense of the picture, all those individuals that are engaging that are part of the evolutionary process too. All the descending sons are part of the evolutionary process. It isn't some pure existential being that's coming out and, injecting something by fiat. So it all is evolution. And so that's why, you have statements like they just made there. if it seems like something is not adequate, you know, just expand the context, you know, and give it a greater span of process, you know, and you'll encompass everything that's needed, and what needs to be will roll out. Right? It's just inescapable, because it's, because again, we have to remember that no matter how difficult it is to let go of the belief that time is a reality, and how we project that on our understanding of everything, really, the finite is just a downstepped expression of the absonite. And the absonite is just a downstepped expression of the absolute. Right? And in that absoluteness, there is the cosmos infinite. There is, not there will be, right? There is the cosmos infinite. So, you know, the fact that, you know, that's the reality of it, that it's coming down, it means that inescapably there will be, like I said, if you have a big enough scope and a long enough span of process, you know, you, what needs to be there is there. It can't be any other way.
Yep. So, stupid question, first mm-hmm. one. Therefore, what do you need revelation for? And the second part of that question is revelation part of evolution?
Yeah, that's the last part is kind of what I was trying to get at. In the biggest sense, revelation is evolution, because the revelators are part of the evolutionary process.
All revelation.
Okay. Right? It's all just part of the evolutionary process, you know, and all of free will, you know, has this very mysterious relationship to all of that, you know.
If that revelation falters, evolution still gets you to where you're going.
Yeah, that evolution might be just a seemingly hands-off sort of a thing, you know. But of course, God the Mother is a person, and it's not really an impersonal, quote unquote, hands-off thing. But you know, it may not be just that. There may be other descending sons that, you know, will pick up the slack in various ways, or there'll be beings that come into play that don't normally come into play, and that seems like, oh, that's a handy coincidence. But of course, in supremacy, there are no coincidences. I see, when all is said and done, you know, everything that looked like it was kind of people scrambling to make up for issues and stuff, no, it all ends up being exactly what it's supposed to be. For the whole thing to be genuinely evolution, the entire universe of universes to be genuinely evolutional, right? There's even mysterious things. Remember, there's no, you know, personality evolution going on in the outer space levels, but there's physical evolution, right? There's even subtle things of all of that seemingly, well, it's just out there and doesn't have any consequence to us, but it does in some way that eventually become very obvious, probably in the the latter days of the grand universe, when it'll suddenly become apparent that if all that mysterious stuff in the first outer space level or whatever wasn't just as it is, you couldn't get the grand universe settled in light and life. It's a part of the evolutionary process too. Somehow, in order for you to become a seven-stage spirit, certain precise things have to be in place in the second outer space level. Not because, you know, it needs to be kind of expecting you in some way. No, it's more holistic than that. It's less temporal than that. Okay. And just, you know, so just to keep that in mind, that, you know, and yet don't diminish the reality of your free will one iota. And nothing is predestined. If you want to use that destined word to speak of what I'm talking about, more to the point is that everything is post-destined. not predestined. I mean, which direction is your destiny, after all? We tend to think of it as being in the opposite direction of your origin, history, destiny. So the antecedent following, all those sorts of things that I often say to just kind of tease about, to not think of things so temporally and linearly. Did you have something?
So you're talking about kind of a top-down.
Right, top-down, is another way that we sometimes speak about it. In this particular case, the top-down would be eternity viewpoint instead of the quote-unquote bottom-up time viewpoint.
Yep. And then just one more quick thing. So we talked about how revelation is part of evolution, and even an emergency revelation like this is because maybe the wheel on the wagon is so loose that it's like, okay, we got to tighten this up or things are going to...
And again, the beautiful thing to think about is none of us can even remotely imagine what the greater significance of this revelation is. It appears that it's just for us and for now, but not really. See, again, it's really something, it's a downstepped expression of something in supremacy. That when you downstep supremacy down into time, there's coincidentally a sequence of events where there's a rebellion and a fault, and the beings involved all make free will choices and decide what needs to be done is a fifth epical revelation, and yada, 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 okay? But when all is said and done, there really aren't any coincidences or kind of any sort of genuinely in and of yourself acts. I mean, even when you consider the absolute dimension in your person of your personality, or the absoluteness of the universal Father, or any other absoluteness, all of that is within a super absolute context that's not moved by it, that bounds it, limits it, makes it so in absoluteness, right, there are no coincidences. See, you just, everything is encompassed by the Trinity Infinite, right? And so in that highest sense, it all must be in some very generalized way what it must be. And yet there's free will. Yeah. And actually, when I take it all the way super absolute like that, that actually allows you kind of a straightforward way to understand how I can have free will. I don't have a super absolute dimension to my personality. That which is transcendent to the absolute can deal, from the beginning has already dealt with, all absolute choices. Just like all finite choices can be managed by that which is transcendent of the finite, by the supreme mind. It can deal with any finite set of facts. It's like, oh, yeah, sure, that's no problem. That's the way we think about it from the time viewpoint, that it deals with the finite facts. But see, actually, it's already dealt with, in a sense. See, I mean, it's the fix is in. I mean, supremacy doesn't result from finity. Supremacy precedes finity, no matter how illogical that sounds from the time viewpoint. But if you remind yourself, well, okay, but time is not reality. So this time viewpoint thing, okay, I can't set that in too firm an existential stone, as can I?
Why is there a free will?
Right? So you can get into some really big questions. Why is there free will? Basically, there is just will, and it's free. And it's sort of a secondary issue that it's distributed, that it all isn't resident in one being, one singular fact, God the Infinite, and nothing else.
Well,
Right? There's just will, and it's distributed. It doesn't seem a mystery. If all there is just one pool of will that it would be free, what would it be subject to? It's no less free when you distribute it. So it's innately free, but it's free in a context. Not even the Universal Father is the author of the context. You know, you don't even have to go up very high. I mean, step one when he comes into existence is put himself into cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity. You know, let alone that which is transcendent to the Paradise Trinity. So, it's just, if someone tries to exercise their will in defiance of the inescapable context, the only way to resolve that is for them to cease to exist, because the context won't move. And if you won't subordinate to it, then by definition, you can't exist.
Oh, that's, yeah.
See? There's no place for you to exist. Nothing exists unto itself. Everything, including the Universal Father, the other two infinite persons, the Paradise Trinity, all that exists in a context. Nothing exists unto itself.
Vital distinction.
Yeah.
As I was driving downtown tonight, I saw a big billboard put up there by the Freedom from Religion folks. Pictures of people, we are atheists and we vote.
What is that supposed to mean?
That's intended to strike fear in my heart.
Mm-hmm.
I'm supposed to read it. Oh my!
Yeah, I believe in a certain measure of nothingness, and I vote. Well, that's unfortunate. Yeah. Anyway. Okay. So, kind of. Now back to the immediacy of the paper here. So the rest of that first little paragraph that doesn't take us off into super absoluteness. Notice what they said right in there about they mentioned both Caligasti and Adam. So in other words, okay, yeah, we talked about the prince and his staff and the rebellion. And they came as the civilizational uplifters. So then subsequent to that, we had those civilization papers. We talked all about the evolution of civilization. And then we brought in Adam and Eve. And we talked about all the immediate consequences, biologic and cultural and whatnot, to Adam and Eve and their descendants. And see, now we need a paper to put a bow on both those stories, right? We have to finish the civilizational story that we started in the wake of talking about the prince and his staff. But the only way you can finish that story is if you take it aside and introduce Adam and Eve and those immediate consequences, and because they have a huge impact on civilization. So now we can finish that story. So on the one hand, this is the final paper in sort of the Adam and Eve series of papers, but it's also hearkening back as a sort of a final paper for the civilization papers in the wake of talking about the planetary prince and his staff. Okay, so that's the deal with this paper. That despite the fact that there was issues with both of those revelations, evolution, right, is going to keep right on marching. The supreme mind, if we're going to look at it like that, the supreme mind is going to do something productive relative to evolution with whatever happens. Rebellion, no rebellion. Default, no default. Whatever. It's just going to keep rolling on. Okay. All right, what's the other little tidbit they give us in the preface here?
The influence of the violet race, though in numbers smaller than had been planned, produced an advance in civilization which, since the days of Adam, has far exceeded the progress of mankind throughout its entire previous existence of almost 1 million years.
Ah, right. So the other thing they want to tell us is the basics of what I was just saying. You can't tell the rest of the civilization story until you first introduce Adam and Eve and their consequences, because their consequences are radically geometric. Right? This isn't just an arithmetic addition to the process. What's added because of that genetic uplift makes everything prior in some sense negligible. You can just continue to say that. I mean, and you can take ever shorter chunks of time in the near recent ages, and say, well, basically, everything happened there. In relative terms, really nothing happened before that, right? And et cetera, et cetera. And that can be a positive or a negative, like I point out. I mean, the negativity relative to civilization that's come into existence in the last 5 years makes all of the negativity that's come into existence relative to civilization since the beginning of the 20th century basically negligible. It's that horrendous, okay? When it goes geometric because of spiritual influence, be it positive or negative, it has this exponential curve to it. Okay, and so that's remember that's the basics of that biologic uplift. In the simplest adjutant sense, right? You're heightening the natural engagement of the seventh adjutant to the mortals of that world when they get biologically uplifted, which means automatically because of that, you're heightening the engagement of the encirclement of the Holy Spirit. You're heightening the potential for personality manifestation, right? That spiritualized mind is more in play for good or for ill. Okay.
Section 1, the cradle of civilization. For about 35,000 years after the days of Adam, the cradle of civilization was in southwestern Asia, extending from the Nile Valley eastward and slightly to the north, across northern Arabia, through Mesopotamia, and on into Turkestan. And climate was the decisive factor in the establishment of civilization in that area.
Okay, so the italicized climate again. Yeah, I mean, like I said, you might have thought, Chris is just way overplaying this. It's like, no, I'm not. I mean, look at this. I mean, they're the ones that seem to be almost overplaying this. It's like, how many times are they going to italicize it even and just keep pounding on this? See, the revelation is making a very definitive statement that you have to think of climate as part of what varies.
Part of evolution.
Right, it's part of evolution. And it's this, there are no coincidences, part of evolution where, coincidentally there's this stimulus where people move here or they do this instead of that. Especially if you are very fascinated by the concept of progress, in contrast to stasis, right, everything evolves together, right? Progress is an evolutionary fact. You can't expect there to be an evolution of a world all the way deep into light and life without all kinds of climatic change. Right? It's inescapable, right? There's going to be lots of geologic change. There's going to be lots of climatic change, et cetera. Everything, changes because it's all one system. You can't really change one part and not have all the other parts change. There really isn't such a thing.
And, a while back you mentioned how the planetary whatever overseers, they knew to have all of this not shale, but what's
the coal, the carboniferous bed, yeah.
And, you know, mm-hmm. all of these things that have been stored that we're using now, which is, of course, going to create the warming.
Yeah, and again, you know, I'm not saying that humans shouldn't have lots of wisdom about their actions. Yeah, don't interpret what I'm saying in some sort of mindless dichotomy. But change the climate will. And it's like, yes, but humans are not supposed to be the cause of that. Well, of course we are. The closer we get to light and life, the more we are responsible for everything that changes. Right? We're becoming a very definitive manifestation of personality management. One way or another, humans will change the climate. Doesn't mean that what we might be doing now is what we're supposed to be doing or blah, 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 right? But see, you know, don't get sucked down into the minutiae. Get the big picture first. One way or another, humans will change the climate. So then humans just need to figure out when and how and where and what. I mean, you know, there is no real if. Humans will change the climate. That's what happens on every world.
And control the climate.
And completely control the climate eventually, yes. Right? Or be, you know, at least we will be a very integral part of its control. Obviously, master physical controllers are involved in stuff too. But, right? But they're just helping out with our world. It's still our world. It's not someone else in the universe's world. It's our world. Our world to assume eventually complete personality domination over.
Eventually,
yeah.
We'll be able to get a little gray hot.
So, yeah. So,
if anybody remembers,
you know, so when it's very important to get these big picture lessons from the Revelation, so that's the predicate. When you go to think about the complicated issues of some specific thing right now, right there, whatever, you know, and you try to figure out, well, what's the wise thing to do here, you know, or what are we supposed to be? But, you know, if you start with the false assumption, it's like, well, okay, the first thing we know is humans absolutely shouldn't be doing anything to the climate. See, that's an absolutely false assumption. Okay? And see, the Revelation is... It's like we see all the time. And when you finally get the Revelation, you go, wow, it's actually telling me that all of our assumptions are exactly opposite of what they should be. Yes, of course they are. There wouldn't be an emergency if you were off by 1 degree. It's only an emergency if you're off by 180 degrees.
You get a postcard.
By definition, all of them are off by 180 degrees. Okay. All right. And that is, you know, a difficult thing to face. Yes. If you've put a lot of your sense of self or whatever, you know, into some ideology, you know, with certain initial assumptions. You're not inclined to immediately go, whoops, those are off by 180 degrees. I've been living my whole life based upon an abject falsehood.
Yeah,
you know, it's like, well, let's think about it a second. See, is it surprising that a completely ignorant child of God would begin their existence relative to eternity living their life based upon abjectly false initial assumptions? I mean, what else would you start with besides that? You couldn't start with anything else but that. That's just natural. Mm-hmm. Of course you have the opposite assumptions. What else would a child of God have? Right? Adults of God have the correct initial assumptions, not children.
You wouldn't choose the divine life, or yourself,
like, per se. Right? See, and that's the whole point. I mean, Havona natives are born with the correct initial assumptions in their head. That's already all done. So by definition, everyone born out here is born with the opposite in their head. And you have the free will opportunity to rotate your initial assumptions 180 degrees and line up, you know, with the eternal domain of the central universe. Yeah, this local system starts out 180 degrees off of its relationship to the pattern, one of those billion worlds in the central universe that, you know, it's predicated on. And coincidentally, over time, this the evolution of this local system swings around so that it's lined up precisely parallel with that world. And that's the whole process. And it does it not mechanically, where it just rotates and everyone is drug along with it. No.
Free will
is intimately involved in all that. It's just, see, it's an incredible dance that occurs. Fascinating process.
You're talking about climate. I think of, you said mind-made and personality-managed. Mind is going to dominate or control the matter.
Mm-hmm.
So the book tells us about how when we're settled in light and life, the climate's also going to be settled like that too. And knowing that, when things come up about climate now, where there's a lot of tension between mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. right thing to do, or the right way to look at it, that big picture, knowing that moving toward it, not that we're anywhere near it, but like life, but that makes me okay with things that happen.
Yeah, and it's an evolutionary process. So humans will decide they want to do something, and that leads to tribulation, and they get wisdom from that tribulation. Okay, we're not going to do that again. Or they decide not to do something, and that leads to tribulation, and go, oh, we're not going to not do anything again. We're going to do something next time. I mean, whichever way, right? I mean, you just have to go through the process, and inexorably, all the initial things lead to tribulation in one way or another. There is no choice that can be made, you know, in the early stages of an evolutionary process that, okay, that just eliminated all tribulation now. No, I mean, every choice leads to tribulation. I mean, you know, don't decide that a choice is good or bad because the good ones lead to no tribulation and the bad ones lead to, no, all choices lead to tribulation. That's the evolutionary process. The only choices that won't lead to tribulation in the finite are the very last choices when everything transcends the finite. But before that, there's still a measure of wisdom that needs to be gained. So there has to be tribulation. Everything has to lead to tribulation one way or another. You know, effort, struggle, conflict. Right? It's not like there's a choice that goes around the conflict and ends up with progress. I mean, all choices go through conflict. It's just, it's inescapable. Okay, so, we just have to face the rugged truth, see, of this, right? Evolution is not for timid souls. Timid souls believe there's a choice that eliminates tribulation.
Yeah.
There is no such choice. Okay. And that's not something that a timid soul finds a delightful revelation. Right? You'd like to be affirmed that there is a certain choice. You know, if it aligns with this ideology, where if you make those choices, then everything is sunshine and lollipops.
Yeah.
Right? There just isn't such a thing.
Then you wouldn't have to feast on uncertainty and famine and disappointment. Right. Enthused in the face of apparent defeat.
Right. See, if there were choices that, see, then that couldn't be true. You know, what he's, that wonderful statement there, right? When they're talking about the getting into the central universe. Right, you've discovered and have no issue anymore by the time you get to the central universe with the fact that all your choices lead to tribulation. And you delight. It's like, I'm going to make a really definitive choice, and I can hardly wait for the challenge of the tribulation this produces and to face that and overcome that. Right?
Somehow get around and avoid it. At some point, I'll grow up so much I will not have to continue falling flat on my face.
Yeah.
It's called Havona.
Yeah.
You can also have peace with that if you can grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you can have peace with that if you recognize that no matter what the tribulation is, no real harm befalls you.
Yeah.
Actual harm, you know, relative to time and infinity and whatnot, yes. But not no real harm. No matter what the tribulation, no real harm befalls you. See, little did you know that what seemed to be so straightforward actually inescapably invokes all these big picture thoughts. That's what truth does. Okay.
It was the great climatic and geologic changes in northern Africa and western Asia that terminated the early migrations of the Adamites, barring them from Europe by the expanded Mediterranean and diverting the stream of migration north and east into Turkestan. By the time of the completion of these land elevations and associated climatic changes, about 15,000 BC, civilization had settled down to a worldwide stalemate, except for the cultural ferments and biologic reserves of the Andites, still confined by mountains to the east in Asia and by the expanding forests in Europe to the west.
Okay, so notice one of the things they're doing with this capstone paper is bringing in summaries of previous material. They're wanting to do something transcendent of what they did before. And so you have the details before, and we were working with the sort of the super summative consequences there. But then you take all the details and you summarize them and you lay out those nuggets, and then there's going to be a super summative thing that you're wanting to recognize kind of on top of that. It's like when we went through all the biologic evolution papers, and then we had this curious paper that seemed to kind of retell the whole story, you know, in synopsis form, right? The overcontrol of evolution, right? And it's like, oh, this is the biologic facts all described in paper after paper after paper. And then one paper that gives you a thumbnail sketch of that biologic foundation as changes and wants you to focus on the mind evolution, right, that's riding above that, you know, and is actually why there is biologic evolution. It's coming down from mind to matter. Okay. So you see we have a similar thing here. We're getting these summaries, and they're wanting you to think about kind of just the basic nuclear nuggets or whatever you want to say of the detailed story we've told and sweep through that for some more rarefied truth, if you will. So you've got those key things. Remember how 15,000 BC was what they said was the beginning of sort of genuine Andite migration, you know, phenomenon, leaving anything that is properly called Adamite or Adamsonite, you know, or Nodite, you know, leaving that behind. Okay, and again, stressing that what we talked about, we've got these climatic and geologic changes, and it's forcing things to play out in certain ways. You know, just when they summarize it, you can see it, and the statements go, oh, wow, the humans are being manipulated by their environment, right? It's just, when you summarize it, it's sort of just right there, diverting, right, the stream of migration, you know, things like that, things have put them into a stalemate, or right. So they're kind of helpless victims of the environment. Well, when you become a helpless victim of the environment, it's now time to reach higher within you, right? To something that can be the source of an originality that can transcend what you're up against, right? You need some creativity. You need some human nature, and like we saw, if you think back, that was the story we often told about how just how fertile a potential there was in those Andites, to be the source of a solution to a problem. You know, whereas an evolutionary, more basically evolutionary being, is just a helpless victim. They're just, you know, if it shoves them into a stalemate there, they sit and they just sort of fester and rot in a pool until they cease to exist, right? Whereas creativity can do something with it.
Like us now trying to deal with climate control.
Climate change or whatever. Yeah, whatever it might be. Yeah, all of the things that obviously need some sort of wisdom, whether it's climate or government or whatever it is. Yeah. And that, no, little footnote on the climate thing. Remember, it's not until deep enlightened life that the sun is put into a stable mode. As long as the sun can change, the climate's going to change, okay? No matter what humans do. We're kind of, you know, small, right, compared to that great big orb in the sky. So, you know, obviously, until the master physical controllers make that a fixed object way, way in the future, inescapably the Earth is going to change because of that. Okay, think how much change the sun could undergo in millions and millions and millions of years, right, into the future. So, all right, let's see, anything else there? We'll see. Notice that last little thing. Remember, we had the whole bit about once the rain-laden winds shifted, you started getting forests and forests and nothing but forests in Europe, and how significant that was. All right, keep going.
Climatic evolution is now about to accomplish what all other efforts had failed to do. That is to compel Eurasian man to abandon hunting for the more advanced callings of herding and farming. Evolution may be slow, but it is terribly effective.
There it is again. And the climate thing. And it's like, oh, how did the universe, you know, if you will, solve the problem of the rebellion and the default? Climate change. It changed the climate and made up for what the revelations that, you know, because they dropped the ball, failed to do. See, the fix is in. Isn't that a radically different picture than the crazy, you know, sky is falling chicken little sort of mentality, you know, that we have these days?
Now is a divine dispensation.
And notice, like I said, how they worded that. It's terribly effective. You know it's bad because I can imagine it being terrible. No, that's not the definition of goodness. If I feel icky, it's bad. If I feel pleasant, it's good.
We don't know that,
Chris. I mean, just look at the word. They could have said it may be slow, but it is effective. Or they could have said very effective, or, you know, whatever. Definitively effective. No, they said terribly effective. You will change. You will be forced to use your mind. You will adapt. You will change. Right? You will have to be creative, or you will be rolled over. That's just the way it works. So again, you just, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't consider the negative impacts of our actions on the environment or whatever, okay? But we have, you know, just totally false big picture assumptions that we're working within, right, as we're trying to think about the details.
Are there other things besides climate change that serve the purpose of the Supreme to move us like this?
Like they already mentioned one, geologic changes.
Okay.
I mentioned another one, solar changes.
All right.
Uh, uh, changes in where the solar system is, you know, in the background of the Milky Way, you know, different energy environments that we move in, into, out of, and a billion things we can't even imagine.
Those are all physical things.
All kinds of physical cattle prods. Huh. As you can see, that's what they're talking about. And it's those cattle prods, like the indispensables, like slavery, war, social classes, and profit motive. Mm-hmm. Right? These other physical things are the same sort of harsh cattle prods. You know, I'm not going to move. You can't make me. You can't make me. Don't ever say that. The universe will just get a bigger cattle prod, okay? And eventually you will move.
Tempt not your power director.
Yes. Yeah. Tempt not the vast conspiracy of supremacy, okay? Because if you don't choose, you know, you will be moved, right? So yeah, it's just it's so direct. You know, to say it, climatic evolution is now about to accomplish what all other efforts have failed to do. All of these high beings that came, it's like, oh, if only we had a high being would come and save us from all of our problems. No. Okay. A lot of times that doesn't work so well. Maybe what you need is just climate change. Yeah, like I said, if you take it high enough, that being that's doing it, you know, is, you know, quote unquote, the supreme being. Okay. Anyway, so you get the point. You know, it's it's just inescapably, as we seem like we're just retracing the same details we talked about. But man, we're not talking about detail things. We're talking about every time we read something, we end up talking about all these grand sweeping things. See? I told you it was inescapably going to put us into a very overarching mode.
When I think of the Supreme, I think of glacial speed.
Mm-hmm.
And glaciers is also another one of those.
Right, exactly. Right. Yeah, and they were just kind of all part of the whole climate change thing. You know, they were just the hammer of climate change. Mm-hmm. All right. Speaking about those indispensables.
Since slaves were so generally employed by the earlier agriculturalists, the farmer was formerly looked down on by both the hunter and the herder. For ages, it was considered menial to till the soil. Wherefore, the idea that soil toil is a curse, whereas it is the greatest of all blessings. Even in the days of Cain and Abel, the sacrifices of the pastoral life were held in greater esteem than the offerings of agriculture.
That's it again. So they're just reminding us of, we're going to talk about the evolution of civilization, how what went on with Adam and Eve is, you know, immediately fits into that conversation. You know, if you're not aware when they're talking about the curse thing there, soil toil is a curse. Remember, that's the way the story is told in the Old Testament about the default, you know, quote unquote. And then, of course, Cain and Abel, with Cain wanting to do the first garden thing of agriculture and Abel being more of an evolutionary, in an evolutionary mode, with herding. And how that all played out. But see, they're, you know, you can tell they're building up to talk again about what they mentioned before of how changes drove people to agriculture inescapably, without having Adam and Eve right there sort of fostering it very directly and nurturing it, you know, showing them agriculture. And it's like, can you do this? You know, I mean, you know, without them, there is that blatant example nonetheless. Right? We get motivated forward in that hunter, herder, farmer sequence. Yep.
So how deep is the saying, this is the greatest of all blessings?
Oh, yeah.
I remember being in a class with Jim McNally one time talking about tilling the soil is something that I think they do in light in life. It's like it's something that, you know, I don't know if any of it, when you do your own garden, it just does something to you.
The big thing about the blessing kind of ties in, again, why there's an emergency, why this book is in my lap, as I always say. We're getting detached and we're floating up into very impractical, idealistic musings and beliefs, right? That's one of the main things why they're saying it's the greatest of all blessings. That curse of detaching from being grounded, right, is militated against by being forced to have your hands down in the soil. Right? You can't be up in some ivory tower foolishness. It keeps you grounded. It helps to balance an ever more spiritualized mind from floating off on false tangents. You know, you can't, no matter how much you believe that you don't need to water plants for them to grow, if you don't water them, they die. Right? You're just forced to engage the facts of reality. Whereas we see so many people that want us to predicate our society on some belief that has no grounding in reality. It's a false initial assumption. So that's it's the greatest blessing because it forces that balance between material pragmatism and spiritual idealism so that there can be a super additive consequence. You know, of cosmic consciousness. And of course, it's that cosmic consciousness that's a blessing, specifically, that synchronization with the whole. Okay.
Man ordinarily evolved into a farmer from a hunter by transition through the era of the herder. And this was also true among the Andites. But more often, the evolutionary coercion of climatic necessity would cause whole tribes to pass directly from hunters to successful farmers. But this phenomenon of passing immediately from hunting to agriculture only occurred in those regions where there was a high degree of race mixture with the violet stock.
See, so you need that originality potential to a significant degree for you to even have the imaginative possibility of skipping over an evolutionary step, if you will. The run-of-the-mill it's way too abstract a step. It's like we talk about with the Andonites. It's way too abstract a step to go to grandchildren. They can wrap their mind around children, okay, that's because it's so immediate. But grandchildren was just an incomprehensible concept. They had no way to imagine some connection between them and that grandchild. That seems impossible for us to imagine, right? It's like, well, just put two and two together. I mean, it's your children, and those came from your children. They're like, but you know, just think about not having the imaginative ability to take that step. You know, you remember people go, one, two, well, see, I'm fuzzed out. Many. Right? They couldn't even get to three.
Two and two is way too
many. Right, see? So, you know, we take a lot of things for granted because mind has evolved a lot and we've gotten biologic uplift and stuff, you know. So here, just dealing with another example of if you didn't have that greater uplift, you didn't have enough imagination to say, like, oh, the solution is to go to agriculture. And then I can deal with this environment that's really seems to be conspiring for my demise. I can become the master of this, and I will not die tomorrow. You may recall, you know, it wasn't that long ago that they talked about this when they, you know, back just in the preceding paper, you don't have to go there, I'll just remind you what it said, as the rain winds shifted to the north, the great open grazing lands of Europe became covered by forests. These great and relatively sudden climatic modifications drove the races of Europe to change from open space hunters to herders, and in some measure to fishers and tillers of the soil. So they basically told us that before. Let's see, they're bringing it in again. And we kind of want to see why. Why are they sort of picking up that thread and getting us to think about it again? So let's keep going.
The evolutionary peoples, notably the Chinese, early learned to plant seeds and to cultivate crops through observation of the sprouting of seeds accidentally moistened or which had been put in graves as food for the departed. But throughout Southwest Asia, along the fertile river bottoms and adjacent plains, the Andites were carrying out the improved agricultural techniques inherited from their ancestors, who had made farming and gardening the chief pursuits within the boundaries of the Second Garden.
Okay, so you can kind of see the main thing that they're wanting to bring in there. I stressed this a few times before, like relative to the prince and his staff, for instance, and here again, relative to what was going on, say, in the Second Garden, relative to Adam and Eve and the immediate descendants, it can go forward a long time, and you kind of just, forget about a lot of that stuff in a direct way that were taught way back when. But then situations get difficult, and you pull back on the reins. You go, wow, we need to stop for a second. We need a clever idea. We're in a difficult situation here. Oh, yeah, what about those agricultural techniques that our forefathers taught us back in the Second Garden? That's the trick. So they'll hearken back. So it isn't totally, just their raw imaginative ability. They're able to reflect back and pick up a thread that was handed to us by revelators that has been dropped and, pick it back up again. Remember what so-and-so, said in on the prince's staff or whatever.
Yeah. Yep. Well, it seems like there must have been some people, even if they were a small minority,
mm-hmm.
that kept these concepts alive.
Yeah, they at least kind of kept it alive in stories about what was done.
Yeah.
See, at the very least, it was being handed down. Even if they weren't literally still practicing like that, because they were in a different situation and they had to adapt or whatever, but they still remembered those techniques and could, like I said, could. It's like instead of just telling stories about them, they could do them again. Okay, but there's all obviously there's also going to be some that were. Very limited number that was still literally doing some of these things in certain places. But, remember, we're thinking about people have gone way far away from Mesopotamia. And obviously, thousands and thousands of years later, have gotten into a certain evolutionary flow relative to that place and that time. But they haven't totally lost touch with what was given. So this... this whole bit about evolution coming around and doing what Revelation failed to do, not totally devoid of the influences of revelators. And in a sense, see, that's why, like I said, you have to think even bigger, that what those revelators did was part of the bigger evolutionary process. Okay, so that's the, they want to just you to think about, how it all plays together a little bit more. See, they want you to think in a little bit more synthetic, holistic fashion about kind of the way this all works and how this all plays together in the end.
Okay. For thousands of years, the descendants of Adam had grown wheat and barley, as improved in the garden, throughout the highlands of the upper border of Mesopotamia. The descendants of Adam and Adamson here met, traded, and socially mingled.
See, so they're mentioning about the beginnings of things, you know, getting that intermingling going that heads towards 15,000 BC in the Andites. But see, in the process, they reminded you there was all kinds of selective breeding plants that Adam and Eve introduced and had been going on. And so even if people stopped really relying upon, say, wheat and barley, that wheat and barley is still growing somewhere. Okay? And you could go and, oh, here's some great stuff. You know, you don't have to start from scratch. It isn't the ancient, you know, non-modified grains, right? They're there in modified fashion, growing somewhere.
Oh no, they're GMO.
Yeah, everything is. Yeah, all of our food is genetically modified, right? If it wasn't done in a lab, it was done in the field. I mean, that's just the way it is. You know, that fancy wheat that we grow in big fields didn't, you know, come out of the evolutionary process like that. Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, and we know that very immediately, like with corn. I mean, the first corn we found doesn't look like those beautiful stalks in Iowa, for Pete's sake.
Right. There's wiser and less wise kind of
modifiers. Yes, right. I mean, but that's the whole thing. It's not that you shouldn't modify. You matter of fact, you will modify. It's like, wow, well, if I will modify, I guess I've got to have the wisdom to modify well. Yeah, that's the whole point. Right? All right.
It was these enforced changes in living conditions which caused such a large proportion of the human race to become omnivorous in dietetic practice. And the combination of the wheat, rice, and vegetable diet with the flesh of the herds marked a great forward step in the health and vigor of these ancient peoples.
See, so again, on the one hand, you know you had a few people that really picked up on what Adam and Eve were doing in terms of diet and stuff and carried that forward kind of in a, you know, religious fashion like so many people do today about diet. But when all is said and done, it was climate change, right, that basically improved the health and vigor of mankind. You know, and it, most people didn't end up having an omnivorous diet because they were just, you know, sort of religiously imitating Adam and Eve or something. So again, see, the whole point, see, kind of that whole section is how the fix is in. One way or another, a planet gets to light and life. And Prince's staffs do some things or not, Adam and Eve's do some things or not, or whatever. But eventually it's done, and we get there. And that's, in the biggest sense, that's very good news. Should be very reassuring to everyone. It's like, you know, every time you think about, you know, it looks like it's going to be horrible. It's like, well, yeah, okay, there might be 2,000 years of an interregnum, 10 times darker than the Middle Ages. Okay, but evolution can be delayed, but it cannot be stopped. Nothing's going to prevent light and life. It doesn't matter if there's a million years of interregnum, there'll still be the seventh stage of light and life. Nothing can change that.
Just a quick question. It's a little bit off topic, but if the prince's staff, if the prince and the staff hadn't gone into rebellion, Would Adam and Eve have come sooner than they did?
No. No, remember, Adam and Eve came just exactly when they would have, you know, independent of the rebellion, because they come immediately in the wake of just biology unto itself reaching its apex.
Okay.
Yeah, which is about 40,000 years ago, and the, you know, not too long after that, they came. Yeah. You may recall they actually talked about that at the beginning of the Adam and Eve story. They, you know,
but they mentioned would have come to a totally different
world. Yeah, obviously they would have come to a totally different world. Yeah. You know, extremely unlikely they would have defaulted, right? If they would have had an integrous planetary prince to help them out. You know, not to mention they wouldn't have been so daunted by the seemingly inscrutable problems, you know, because there wouldn't have been these inscrutable problems. So they wouldn't have despaired so instantly. Okay. All right, so that's the big deal. They wanted to again just remind you in even kind of more inescapable fashion that you need to be brave, you need to be courageous in the face of the climate. The climate is not going to be what your timid soul hopes it's going to be. It's going to be what it needs to be, and you just have to go with it. Just the fact that, you know, that's such a global problem now. Everyone is all wrapped around the axle about it. Imagine if you were reading this revelation before you had all the, you know, very recent year running around Chicken Little about the changes in the climate. You know, you'd be reading this like, why do they keep talking about climate? Like, what's the deal with all this climate italicizing? And it's like, now it's trivially obvious why they did it, because they knew exactly what we were going to be thinking, when we were going to be thinking it, how confused we would be. You know? So it's all right there to get us clear on that issue, at least in terms of the, you know, the big picture. All right.
Section 2, the tools of civilization. The growth of culture is predicated upon the development of the tools of civilization. And the tools which man utilized in his ascent from savagery were effective just to the extent that they released manpower for the accomplishment of higher tasks.
Okay, so you can kind of already feel what we're picking up here again is, this is definitely is going to be hearkening back to those civilization papers. We'll see very definitively in just a second here. But we can tell from the predicate that they want to remind you that how important science is to civilization, even long before, you kind of have something you would call science in the way we think of that, what that invokes in our minds when we say that word today. But just the rudiments of technology, tools, a way of using your mind over matter abilities beyond your body to help make life less painful, okay? Things to go a little more smoothly. Fewer people dying every time you turn around or whatever. Yep.
Yeah, in the Dark Ages, it's been documented there were slow but steady increases in the technology that people used for. One of the big ones was the horse collar, mm-hmm. which allowed horses to be used as draft animals before they couldn't really harness that power that a horse had.
Yeah.
Like they could an oxen, they used a different...
Right. The yoke, yeah.
The horse wouldn't tolerate that.
Right. Yeah.
So they came up with the idea of a horse collar.
Yep. Something that was more pleasant for a horse's sensibilities of things, and yeah, they would be more accommodating. Yes. Right. So, see, it's that whole toolmaker man. See, we're gonna talk about that in a very generalized sense. We're not gonna be talking about just flint or something, right? But in a more generalized sense.
You who now live amid latter-day scenes of budding culture and beginning progress in social affairs, who actually have some little spare time in which to think about society and civilization, must not overlook the fact that your early ancestors had little or no leisure which could be devoted to thoughtful reflection and social thinking.
Okay, so italicized think in there should make you immediately go to kind of what they want you to. It's your thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you Godward. Okay? Do you appreciate how much you can't, you'll get to that except on the predicate of science? All right? Until there's science to some degree, you don't have the free time to think. And so, do you make any progress Godward? No. Right? And you can even see that very literally when you think about the levels of meaning. All right, when you go in the hourglass analogy, the upper domain, you have levels 4, 5, and 6. On level 4, that's the level of scientific consciousness. You know that level 6 is a level of religious consciousness. Yeah, that God destination that we were just talking about. I can't get to level 6 except predicated on level 4. Right? Not really. Not in any sort of a proper, stable way. Right? Like they tell you, if you try to jump over, you know, which theoretically you can, and just sort of grab the beginnings of stimulation of your mind with the third cosmic intuition on the 6th level, when you don't have the stabilization of that 4th level foundation, will you get proper religious consciousness? No, you'll get fanaticism. You can literally see what they're talking about, you know, within you. And if that's literally within you, a society is made out of individuals constructed like that. So obviously, society at large is going to have the same basic physics, right? Yeah, and they're speaking to that. You need to get, if you're going to have any sort of significant civilization, there has to be time for thoughtful reflection and social thinking. And if you don't have technology predicated on some rudimentary science, you don't have, you know, that luxury is not going to be there. That leisure time is not going to be there.
I heard that in Islam, they don't teach science in school, that they don't really allow you to have that knowledge. Could that be why maybe they have more fanatical religionists, or maybe they don't actually? I don't know.
Well, I mean,
that's true or not.
There's a lot of fanatics outside of Islam, but you can be fanatical about any ideology. It doesn't have to be a religious, so-called religious ideology. But
look now.
But one of the things, that's one of the problems. In the early days of Islam, when you had those awakenings to the fact that we have this internal insight, that was actively suppressed. Not just you know, the spiritual insight of the third cosmic intuition, not just the, you know, the moral insight of the second cosmic intuition, but even the logical acumen, right? The predicate of science in the first cosmic intuition. You know, those were declared to be delusional evils, you know, that you have no genuine inner light, right? There is a light, Allah on high, and he shines his light down to a selected individual, a mullah, and his light shines through that individual's mouth, okay? And, you know, you look to that external reference. There is no internal. See, so if you bias people away from the predicate of science, of course, see, in general, science is not going to be fostered, you know, if not actively militated, you know, against. So, you know, there is no inner morality, right? There is no inner insight for as a predicate for science, you know, as if humans could had the ability to distinguish between fact and figment, as if humans somehow could have an insight into something called causality. Just think about it. When you say that to a primitive person, it's like, oh, so you think you're the cause, you think you're God, you think you know causality. Only God knows causality. See, that's the mentality that she's biased against civilizational progress. It's a fear. And see, and it's not an unfounded fear, like we've been talking about. See, the moment I awaken my spiritual nature, I have awakened the double-edged sword. You know, if you want to prevent the negative fruits of my free will, get me to just function as a fancy animal and don't use my spiritualized mind.
Or give you a lot of wisdom.
Right.
No high seas for you. Yeah. You're in a kiddie pool.
You know, and just remember, you know, remember the predicate of Islam. I mean, Muhammad was looking at his people and recognizing, man, if you just let these individuals be the source of how this works, it's just nothing but chaos. We need to just turn off all this seeking inside stuff that's led to just calamity for our people, right? And force it to just an external reference so we can stabilize these people and get them moving somewhere. Right. It was the hopelessness of the individuals that sort of motivated this, screw the individuals, it's just there's going to be an established authority, and he's going to tell you everything to do, and you're going to say, yes, sir, and that's the end of the story. I mean, he was, you know, and that was an appropriate step, but all good things taken to extreme become bad, right? And it started to be taken to an extreme in the 9th and 10th century. When genuine inner light started to dawn, you know, we all know that you know, one of the reasons we made it through the Middle Ages is because the light was burning in Islam, right, and conserving some of this stuff. So the italicized think there, right? So that whole predicate of, if you're going to have that God nucleus for the individuals and hence for civilization, there has to be some measure of taking control of the external world to allow for a genuine inner life, time for a genuine inner life.
The first four great advances in human civilization were: 1, the taming of fire; 2, the domestication of animals; 3, the enslavement of captives; 4, private property.
You go, wait a minute, that sounds vaguely familiar. Yeah, remember, see if my paper's at, that's paper 69. Remember how we had four sections, right? And that we had fire in relation to civilization, the utilization of animals, slavery as a factor in civilization. That's where we got the first indispensable. And then private property. those last sections of paper 69 were about that. So they're, like I said, see, they're definitely hearkening back to the civilization papers and bringing a little synopsis of that up front here, you know, in play again. So they're wanting to do a little thumbnail through those facts again. In the context of what they're immediately, what threads they're immediately following here. Okay. Let's see what they do.
While fire, the first great discovery, eventually unlocked the doors of the scientific world, it was of little value in this regard to primitive man. He refused to recognize natural causes as explanations for commonplace phenomena.
Okay, so see, there you see it very directly. You know, and you may remember that, you know, how obviously how fundamental energy, the concept of energy is to science, right? And moving forward with science and technology. But see, so it's not just the limited imagination of the people, like we were talking about a little bit ago, that's a problem. But you have this, there's none so blind as those who will not see thing coming into play very early on too, because of evolutionary religion. It didn't say he could not recognize natural causes. Yeah, he refused to recognize natural causes, explanations for commonplace phenomena. No matter how trivially obvious, he would blind himself to it. You know, we saw some exceptions up there in the previous preceding section. They said the evolutionary peoples, notably the Chinese, early learned to plant seeds and to cultivate crops through observation of the sprouting of seeds accidentally moistened or which had been put in graves as food for the departed. See, that's a little bit of deductive. It's like, wait a minute. Those are the same things we planted with that person for the afterlife, and now they're growing. Oh, I'm putting two together here.
You've got to burn your bodies in your
mind. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Sometimes there's unfortunate associations that are, that people conclude. But, even simple things like that, people were often willfully blinding themselves to the obvious natural causality there. It's like, no, there is no such thing as natural causality. I refuse to believe in any natural causality. Everything is caused by the whims of spirit beings. Period. End of story. And anyone who says otherwise will be immediately sent to the happy hunting grounds. Okay? They were ruthless in this. Anyone that started to think in a scientific way was labeled a sorcerer, a wizard, right? Whatever. At the very least shunned, if not just executed,
Mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And we see that Sangic mind when someone is a very progressive people, those who just don't have any natural sense of such things, being a people with an orientation to the future. What do those non-future-oriented people call the progressive people? The great Satan. Mm-hmm. See, just what we're talking about here. See? That's evil. If for nothing else, like I said, the more intellectual ones know that harkens back centuries before. It's like, wait a minute, those people think that they actually have some knowingness that's just inside of them. It doesn't matter how cool the stuff is that they do predicated on that claimed inner light. By definition, it's not cool, it's evil. So we still see the same mentality playing out today. It's just not as absolutist as it was, you know, way back. Even the most backward people today will allow for some natural causes. You know, and that's kind of inescapable. See, when you go all the way to monotheism, you know, like Islam is definitely monotheistic. So you don't have an infinite number of spirits, whimsical spirits, you know, to micromanage every detail, you know, that happens. You know, every raindrop is guided down by a spirit being. You know, it doesn't fall because of gravity, or you know, they literally thought that way. So obviously, you know, that moving to monotheism helps greatly with, being so absolutist about this refusal to recognize natural causes. Okay.
When asked where fire came from, the simple story of Andon and the Flint was soon replaced by the legend of how some Prometheus stole it from heaven. The ancients sought a supernatural explanation for all natural phenomena not within the range of their personal comprehension, and many moderns continue to do this. The depersonalization of so-called natural phenomena has required ages, and it is not yet completed. But the frank, honest, and fearless search for true causes gave birth to modern science. It turned astrology into astronomy, alchemy into chemistry, and magic into medicine.
That last sentence is one I'm sure a lot of longtime readers remember. It's a classic. All right, so you take out all of this micromanagement of everything by whimsical spirits, and you courageously face the fact of the insight of your first cosmic intuition. Frank, honest, fearless search for true causes gave birth to modern science. And right there you see what we were just talking about a minute ago. And many moderns continue to do this. And notice the insidious thing when you go from sacred totalitarianism, where you have... it only lasts for a while and helps a little bit when you, like I said, when you go to monotheism, but eventually you get kind of a less lowly anthropomorphic monotheistic God, and he again starts to take over, and this one God is micromanaging everything again, just like all the countless individual spirits used to be, micromanaging everything. And you have, every storm is an act of God, and yada yada. You know how that goes, so you finally have the secular revolt against that belief, allowing for some genuine science to develop during the Enlightenment. But all good things take it to extreme become bad, and so more and more the secular totalitarianists amongst us. They're getting more and more aggressive. Right? They do the effective same thing. They notice this depersonalization. Okay, yeah, they don't say that a hurricane is caused by that person in the sky, but they blame some person on Earth for the hurricane. It's the exact same thing, see? Right. It's inescapable. Right.
Even on the other side, I have a friend who won't make a move in his company if his chart doesn't tell him. His astronomy chart.
His astrology chart. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell him it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. He just waits. Mm-hmm. It's funny, and it's like to see people captured in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And gosh, you can't tell them otherwise.
Yeah, and you know, just a little side note there on the use of language. It's unfortunate for science, you know, the way it's lost its philosophic context in so many ways, like I so often talk about. In the case of studying, you know, what's in the heavens, see, we used to call that astrology, the logic, right, of the heavens, so that you're reminded, you know, like geology, you know, for instance, you're reminded that this scientific field fundamentally has a philosophic predicate. Right? You're trying to figure out the logic of that part of reality. That word was taken up and diverted off in unfortunate ways, and so they had to coin an alternate word. You know, astronomy. You know, the laws of the stars. Let's see, instead of the logic of the stars. Okay. You are going to be, as a scientist, you're directly trying to figure out the laws, of the stars or of the heavens, okay? But to not have the word, you know, the suffix L-O-G-Y in there is a subtle, unfortunate influence that allows you to forget that there has to be a philosophic context to your scientific endeavor. Okay? So that's kind of a little sad side note about how this process. All right. I think we got everything else here, didn't we? Let's keep going.
In the pre-machine age, the only way in which man could accomplish work without doing it himself was to use an animal. Domestication of animals placed in his hands living tools, the intelligent use of which prepared the way for both agriculture and transportation. And without these animals, man could not have risen from his primitive estate to the levels of subsequent civilization.
Okay, they're reminding you of, you know, what we talked about with the domestication of animals. And back there, like I said, in paper 69... But just notice the way they said it there. The domestication of animals placed in his hands living tools. They're reminding you that in a very broad way, man is beginning to use the fourth adjutant, right? But in a human sense, is the spirit of knowledge. Okay, you don't just see a mere animal when you look at a cow. You say, that's a potential tool. See, that's the fourth adjutant that adds that little overlay on that cow.
As opposed to that's my great grandfather.
Let alone in some sort of totem sense or whatever with the cow, or yeah, who knows what, yeah, or reincarnation sense, or yeah, some evolutionary religion notion. Yeah, but see that's what they're getting at. They're reminding you about how you've got the kind of a new measure of the fourth adjutant coming into play. In the same way, in a much more advanced mode, I talk about how, think about the Industrial Revolution. That in the middle of the 18th century, you have this dawning of the fourth adjutant in the collective. And suddenly there's this civilization predicated on not just a mere individual, like we're talking about here, but very much a group, integrous manifestation of the sense of things that the fourth adjutant brings into play. And then you suddenly have this whole new type of civilization, a technological civilization, that we call the Industrial Revolution. So here, way back, we're you know, we're thinking about that fourth adjutant be, you know, not being something that's sort of just kind of internal scaffolding, but it's starting to manifest in a more observable, socialized way. It's altering the culture of the people, and you know, and allowing for more civilization. Okay.
Most of the animals best suited to domestication were found in Asia, especially in the central to southwest regions. This was one reason why civilization progressed faster in that locality than in other parts of the world. Many of these animals had been twice before domesticated, and in the Andite age, they were retamed once again. But the dog had remained with the hunters ever since being adopted by the blue man, long, long before.
Okay, before we get on that last little point, obviously twice before domesticated, we had, for instance, his staff and Adam and Eve, of course, and now we're way down the road. But you know what they would have been doing and got forgotten is being picked up again through the evolutionary process. It's coming back around again. And just, you know, you see one of the wonderful, coincidentally, all of these domesticatable animals happen to be closely located to where the prince's headquarters was. And it's all was planned that way. If all the easily domesticatable animals were off in North America, okay, instead of right there in their backyard, okay, you know, you go, I'll bet you the prince's headquarters wouldn't have been there. Right? It would have been somewhere else. And so the fact that the climate and geology and stuff conspired so they didn't go too far afield, when evolution finally brought this domestication idea around again, oh, they were still kind of in that region where they were domesticatable animals and it all worked. See? So we're seeing how this vast conspiracy is keeping it going. Okay, and then the whole bit about, you remember way back we talked about the dog, how that was, first domesticated animal. They didn't mention before that it adopted by the blue man long, long ago. Oh, blue man. See, which adjutant does blue man favor out of the six? Oh, yes, the fourth adjutant. Right. He's going, oh, I can think of that like a tool. I could use that as a tool. That could be a guard dog. That's a tool. Eh?
Even that's turned 180 degrees, and now they're the... I saw one at the airport yesterday carrying her dog in her backpack.
Yes, but nonetheless, and see, the fact they bring Blue Man, if you go back to when they were talking about the first board of animal domestication and utilization there with the prince's staff, and they were mentioning such things, they said several types of useful animals now extinct were tamed, together with some that have continued as domesticated animals to the present day. Man had long lived with the dog, and the blue man had already been successful in taming the elephant. There he is again, the blue man. You see, and now you put the two together, it's like, oh yeah. So there was a general tendency out of all the Sangiks for blue man being the spear point in overlaying the fourth adjutant perspective on what was in front of him. It's like, that's not just, that's a potential tool, guys. Let me show you. Okay. So that's, they're just, see, between the lines, it's all very obvious that that's what they're stressing. And like I said, if you think about how in recent times, recent centuries, we have this dawning of the fourth adjutant in the collective, the dawning of the fifth, the dawning of the sixth. That evolutionary process, Yeah, they're just reminding you how, in a less collective way, you're going to have that going on way, way back. That you'll get the fourth adjutant, you know, select individuals that are keen in that sense, kind of bringing it into a play in a simple sense in that culture. There's gonna be a little bit more fifth adjutant, sixth adjutant. You know, you have a budding civilizational phenomena way back when. It's just, you know, the fact that it's going to naturally go in adjutant order because that's the evolutionary order. You know, and like we were saying, it's like, oh, and that's the appropriate order. I mean, it isn't a random, you know, order that the adjutants are in. You need to get the fourth in place before you can get the fifth in place in a way that's going to be stable and enduring, you know, et cetera. Okay? All right, so that's... You can definitely see why they're reminding us about the fire and domestication ones from way back. Okay, what else do we have here?
The Andites of Turkestan were the first peoples to extensively domesticate the horse. And this is another reason why their culture was for so long predominant. By 5000 BC, the Mesopotamian, Turkestan, and Chinese farmers had begun the raising of sheep, goats, cows, camels, horses, fowls, and elephants. They employed as beasts of burden the ox, camel, horse, and yak. Man was himself at one time the beast of burden. One ruler of the Blue Race once had 100,000 men in his colony of burden bearers.
Again, it's Blue Man. It's like, yeah. I need a big toolbox, okay?
That
I'm going to have big animals, and I'm going to have lots of people. Right, 100,000 wrenches, right, in his toolbox. I just, you know, see, again, they're just telling you he's naturally going to lead the way in this regard because of his favoritism of the fourth adjutant. And again, we see them reminding us of how you in many ways have things in place at 5000 BC. You know, a lot of what we think of as sort of a more modern modality of things. You know, and the whole bit about, you know, like we read the Andites going on horseback in that 8000 to 6000 BC, you know, those final waves of the Andites. And so all that's happened okay, and the fact that they went everywhere on horseback, now everyone knows about horses, okay, and it's spread around. All right.
The institutions of slavery and private ownership of land came with agriculture. Slavery raised the master's standard of living and provided more leisure for social culture.
And so, see, that just that little footnote of how those other two fit in, they gave us a little bit different perspective, that we have these individuals that have enough originality of mind that they can skip over herding and go right to farming as a solution to the problem they find themselves in because of the climate and geology and whatnot. And so those other two, as they said up front here, the first four great advances, those other two advances in human civilization, naturally fit into place. So again, it's like they're just trying to point out you didn't need Adam and Eve to just sort of micromanage this and foster this. The whole process led to those four great facts coming into play. And we even see shades of our controversial, indispensable passage about slavery. You know, slavery raised the master's standard of living. You know, just go out on the street corner and, you know, toss that statement out and see how you fare.
Didn't slavery also have something to do with women becoming more having more rights and being more...
Yeah, yeah, we'll get to those issues. You know, that's, of course, the next papers that are coming is the marriage and family papers, and they'll pick up some of these issues again and how it fits in with the whole male-female dynamic stuff, yeah.
Well, at least with slavery, they didn't kill him. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
he didn't have to choice between one and the other.
Yeah. Right. We had the whole bit of eating them to begin with, and yeah. Okay, so they've given us a little thumbnail review, like I said, in this vein. What else they have to say here?
The savage is a slave to nature, but scientific civilization is slowly conferring increasing liberty on mankind. Through animals, fire, wind, water, electricity, and other undiscovered sources of energy, man has liberated and will continue to liberate himself from the necessity for unremitting toil. Regardless of the transient trouble produced by the prolific invention of machinery, the ultimate benefits to be derived from such mechanical inventions are inestimable. Civilization can never flourish, much less be established, until man has leisure to think, to plan, to imagine new and better ways of doing things.
So they wanted to really stress this again, like I was, you know, I basically, you know, gave you the that full impact up front when we talked about that. Yeah, but they italicize leisure there to again stress that. But we all know, yeah, but if you give some people leisure, that is not a positive thing, right? You know, there's a, like I've said, for a lot of people, I think we need some more indentured servitude here. They have way too much free time on their hands. They're just a disaster for all of us. That they have time to be thinking about such things and doing such things, you know. It's a double-edged sword. But see, there must be leisure, so you must have the wisdom to properly use your leisure. You know, the solution is not to, like I was saying, you know, jokingly, eliminate leisure. Now, we need wiser individuals, because leisure there must be, as they're saying there. Civilization can never flourish, much less be established. Right?
Yeah, you don't have time to shop. Right?
Right? It doesn't say it'll take a lot longer for it to flourish. No, it'll never flourish, period. You can forget about the era of light and life. Right? Again, wisdom, we need the wisdom. And notice up front there, the savage is a slave to nature, but scientific civilization is slowly conferring increasing liberty on mankind. If you're thinking precisely, you're going, wait a minute, don't they mean increasing freedom on mankind? Well, yeah, immediately. But see, in the context of that outer life, freedom is the potential for an inner life. The discovery of genuine liberty. Right? There is no liberty in the external world. Liberty is an inner life word. One of the big problems is if you think it's about the outer life, right? And subsequently, your absolute free will should reign out there in the external world. And that leads to lots of problems. Liberty is inside. Liberty is a spirit word. Yeah, when you apply it down into the mind and out into the world, okay, then you talk about freedom. And you can talk about a newfound freedom, a freedom predicated on genuine liberty inside. But see, that's the point. See, that it's conferring increasing liberty. See, you recognize, because I've already set it all up, right? It's your thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you God and all that. So when you get to here, you go, oh, yeah, they do mean liberty there, right? The point is not, in the end, the fancier outer life, right? It's the realization of a genuine inner life, which is not possible until there's some stabilization and control of the outer life. So you're not just a helpless victim to it. Mm-hmm. You know? And it's constantly dragging you down and out. Right? You know, you just can't find the peace of mind to get to an inner life. You have too many feelings about the outer life to ever have an inner life.
And wasn't that one of the three things Jesus taught the apostles to get? Was it? And that was eternal salvation. Then there was divine. There was personal liberty and divine, whatever it is. Can't remember. But that's what he taught people to teach.
Yeah.
And when you talk about liberty, you know, I don't think everybody really understands what you mean by the term.
Yeah.
In terms of.
So that's why I'm trying to teach you. See, again, the revelation is trying to get us to precisely differentiate the word liberty from freedom. Not let those be synonyms. You know, if you look in the dictionary, you can see they aren't totally treated as synonyms, but there's a strong tendency to blur them together. And it's very important. You're blurring the material and the spiritual. You're doing just what Jesus' apostles were always doing, right? For instance, in blurring the material and spiritual.
Spiritual liberty.
Right.
The ability to be able to have your own personal relationship with God in a way.
No one can take your liberty away because it's in the domain where you're sovereign. That, you know, and the moment you think of liberty as being anywhere else is the moment where you're going to start getting very frustrated with your neighbor. Because how dare you usurp my liberty, you know, or whatever. It's like, no, he can't. Your genuine liberty, not even the universal father can touch it. You are absolute sovereign in the domain of genuine liberty. And so stop using liberty for anything else. Right? It's just like free will compared to self-assertion. Right?
So how would you define liberty in that case?
Liberty is, it's my sovereignty, in my inner life. The domain of my spiritualized mind is ultimately subject to my will and my will alone. The forms there are the forms that I dictate. Now, even the fragment of infinity, the Father's adjuster that's inserted into that domain is always subservient to my will. That adjuster, you know, is subject to my liberty, for good or for ill. Yeah, you know, see, and in that context, the adjuster is just a tool of my will. Like we're talking about the tools of, you know, personal creativity here. I can wield that tool to build my soul or tear my soul apart. Yeah. The only way for me to get to iniquity is for me to use my adjuster to rip my soul apart. It's the only tool that you can put on the soul. Right? Nothing else has hands on the soul. The only thing that has hands on the soul is the adjuster. If your soul goes to iniquity, it's because you've used the adjuster to tear it apart.
You have to be somewhat conscious in order to do that.
Well, of course, yeah. I mean, we all know, right? Yeah, I mean, yeah, yeah. You can get off in the whole issue of genuine iniquity is, you know, not an easy task. Okay, but
in the 12 elements of an expanding civilization, profitable utilization of leisure is the sixth, which is the first one of the aspirational elements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and you know, we all know they talk a lot about that when you talk about self-gratification, you know, and how problematic that is amongst those issues. You know, again, the more it's something really of you, right, and your free will, the more potentially problematic it becomes, right? You know, when you're just kind of forced. Yeah, it's like, well, I can only do it this way because, you know, the environment dictates it. Okay, there's a limit to how far you can go astray. You know, how fast can you run if you're in a crowd where it's shoulder to shoulder? You can't run very fast, can you? Right. But you get rid of all the people, right, and you can run and really fast and fall flat on your face. Right. That basic physics of it, of your, you know, of all the problems that resulted from the Lucifer Rebellion, right? I mean, nothing is more problematic than the inability to distinguish between true and false liberty. Like I was just saying. Right? You start putting liberty out there, right? And thinking it makes demands on others. No, it's all just about you.
I remember what that one was. With mm-hmm. spiritual liberty, divine sonship, and eternal salvation.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. So think about it for a second.
Yeah, just wait, before you say, I mean, just, you know, occasionally they'll remind you liberty is a spirit word by putting the word spiritual in front of it, see? Like spiritual pride, you know, or, you know, they often will put the word spiritual just to remind you it's a spirit word.
So you brought up the point of leisure, you know, and you think about it as, I would imagine, as society, and, you know, gets into light and life, and as we grow into spiritual beings, whatever, the leisure aspect is perhaps there more often. That's probably why service is the, you know, the real, what you do with your leisure time. And in a way, in terms of all, remember how they talk about all kinds of different service and so on and so forth, and it's, what do they say, it's the goal of time and the destiny of return of space or something like that, to that degree. But I was just thinking, with the leisure time, if you, you know, 'cause right now, we all know there's a lot of, you have a lot of leisure time. Sometimes, especially if you get to retirement old like me, you're saying, oh gosh, you can't do the same things you used to do. You're going to take up your time. What are you going to do? And service really is one way to be able to turn that leisure time into productive time in a way that, I don't know, fulfills your soul somehow.
Number 7 in those 12 elements is care for the unfortunate.
All right. Yeah. Great thoughts. Yeah. I mean, I hope it, yeah, it's just sparking lots of thoughts in all your minds here.
Man first simply appropriated his shelter, lived under ledges, or dwelt in caves. Next, he adapted such natural materials as wood and stone to the creation of family huts. Lastly, he entered the creative stage of home building, learned to manufacture brick and other building materials.
See, why is it literally the creative stage? Because, see, there's an unnatural originality, see, going on. I mean, it's, you know, first you're just doing what's totally natural, then you're kind of just working with nature, and then you know, and then you're doing something that's genuinely personal, human, creative, or unnatural. Right? There is no such thing as natural bricks. Okay. Okay. See, so they're reminding us. See, that's the whole deal of going from natural to unnatural. You know, the more unnatural things become, the more artificial things become, the more human they become. See, again, the more unnatural, the more artificial the climate, the more human the climate. Mind made and personality managed.
So it'll be relatively human instead of relative humidity?
Some people's children. Yeah. Okay.
The peoples of the Turkestan Highlands were the first of the more modern races to build their homes of wood, houses not at all unlike the early log cabins of the American pioneer settlers. Throughout the plains, human dwellings were made of brick, later on of burned bricks.
See, obviously, even more when you get to burn bricks. That's not going to be highly natural.
The
fact that they're tying in American pioneer settlers, you know, they're just reminding you of how ancient some of these ideas are. You know, we think of sort of that as, well, that's a recent phase we went through. We went through log cabins, and now we have the houses that we have. No, I mean, that's goes way, way back if you talk about the Andites.
The older river races made their huts by setting tall poles in the ground in a circle. The tops were then brought together, making the skeleton frame for the hut, which was interlaced with transverse reeds, the whole creation resembling a huge inverted basket. This structure could then be daubed over with clay and, after drying in the sun, would make a very serviceable weatherproof habitation.
Yeah, look at the sophistication of the tool maker mentality, right? Just how unnatural we are, you know, we're talking now. And that's the, you know, that's just the basic point. And it just, you know, you have greater and greater degrees of genuine creativity coming into play.
Yeah. It was from these early huts that the subsequent idea of all sorts of basket weaving independently originated. Among one group, the idea of making pottery arose from observing the effects of smearing these pole frameworks with moist clay. The practice of hardening pottery by baking was discovered when one of these clay-covered primitive huts accidentally burned. The arts of olden days were many times derived from the accidental occurrences attendant upon the daily life of early peoples. At least, this was almost wholly true of the evolutionary progress of mankind up to the coming of Adam.
Surprised they could put it together.
Yeah, so you're seeing how it may take a long time, but the evolutionary process, slowly it'll dawn in someone's mind. And usually it's part of this vast conspiracy. Well, coincidentally, there was this fire, you know, something very, you know, out of the norm or very overt happened. And they, oh, and you put two and two together. You know, you don't have to be too clever. Even a dense person kind of can put two and two together. And so it's just pointing out how there's this vast conspiracy of the evolutionary process. And just the fact that, you know, it's, I need a very serviceable weatherproof habitation, right? Necessity is the mother of invention. And it's, oh, and now that I've got this very serviceable weatherproof habitation, it gives me an idea. I could make a basket, you know, to carry the gourds in or whatever, right? You know, or I could make a pot, a clay pot to carry water in. Right? So it's, you know, to think that the house came first, see, and the baskets and the pottery came second. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because it was just too abstract to think of a pot to carry water. But you really needed a house. That was sort of inescapable. And then you take these baby steps. Because there's a limit to how far you can jump abstractly to imagine something.
Pretty hard to have leisure without the house.
Yeah, right.
Think about the other stuff.
All right, the house is obviously helping.
Yeah.
House is very much helping with leisure, and the lazy boy followed soon after. Yeah. Okay.
Did Adam and Eve and the prince's staff, did they teach the pots and that sort of thing?
Yeah, yeah.
Just
yes.
Coming back?
Yeah, so that, you know, they're just pointing out that they obviously, you know, brought in a lot of this teaching.
But still had to be rediscovered.
But also, obviously, reminding you that that it's there in the slow evolutionary process. Nonetheless, you don't have to have an Adam and Eve to come and model these things for you.
Okay. While pottery had been first introduced by the staff of the prince about 1.5 million years ago, the making of clay vessels had practically ceased for over 150,000 years. Only the Gulf Coast pre-Sumerian Nodites continued to make clay vessels. The art of pottery making was revived during Adam's time. The dissemination of this art was simultaneous with the extension of the desert areas of Africa, Arabia, and Central Asia. And it spread in successive waves of improving technique from Mesopotamia out over the Eastern Hemisphere.
Again, the vast conspiracy of climatic change. Cattle prodding this dissemination. Okay, so yeah, I mean, we already kind of just talked about that. So, you know, it's, you know, you're just reminded that you know, the powers that be in the universe of universes, you know, don't desire that everything take the longest path possible to get from beginning to end. You know, or you wouldn't send, you know, these helpers like they always do. You know, so it's not necessary that everyone slog through a painfully gradual process. That isn't somehow essential to the evolution of the Supreme. But of course, there will be some that will, because that is, some need to, that, you know, the fact that some do is essential to the completion of the Supreme. Okay? But not all.
So and 150,000 years of none of it was a result of the rebellion?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's just, you know, until, you know, the up from the 200,000 years ago of the rebellion up until, you know, Adam and Eve. Yeah. You know, in other words, Van and Amadon were just doing very minimal things. There was a limit to what they could do. All right. So, yeah. What's our final little thought here?
These civilizations of the Andite Age cannot always be traced by the stages of their pottery or other arts. The smooth course of human evolution was tremendously complicated by the regimes of both Dalmatia and Eden. It often occurs that the later vases and implements are inferior to the earlier products of the purer Andite peoples.
So the end with a little note for the archaeologists,
yeah,
right? You know, kind of like the kind of notes we saw with biologic evolution, that you have to keep in mind. There's you can't think in simplistic linear terms. You at least have to think in, you know, in multiple parallels. You know, in the evolutionary process, not to mention all of these other complexities. You know, like we've talked about a lot. Oh, the Iron Age, that wasn't until 1000 BC. Well, except for, you know, hundreds of, or, you know, not hundreds, tens of thousands of years ago when they were doing iron stuff and then forgot it and had to rediscover it.
I was talking about a while back about, I think it was Gene, on the pyramids, you know, the best was first.
Right, yeah. Right, yeah. Yeah, it might not have been the biggest sort of first or something, yeah, but the highest quality is, like they're pointing out, is often older, see? You know, because genetic degradation of the people, and so the subsequent just can't be as high a quality. You know, they'll be imitating this stuff, and you know, bigger is better. You know, that's simple-minded, childish mentality. They might be doing that, but higher quality is incomprehensible, you know, to the lesser people. Okay, so that's the beginnings of our little resurvey here, and just, you know, I'll just emphasize again. Notice how we talked about factually a number of things that we talked about many times in previous papers, but we inescapably were talking in much bigger picture terms about everything. That's what happens when you condense all the details into a little nucleus summary and then play upon that at a higher level. That's the point of the paper. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.